From feature story news in Washington and our bureaus around the world, this is FSN Reports. I'm Kevin McAleese. On today's programme, seize the opportunity. President Obama tells Russia to engage with Ukraine or face further painful sanctions.
If Russia's provocations continue, it's clear from our discussions here that the G7 nations are ready to impose additional costs on Russia.
Also today, extremists in Nigeria pose as preachers to carry out their latest deadly attack. And a year after whistleblower Edward Snowden's NSA leaks were first published, we hear from the journalist who met him in Hong Kong after he fled the US.
I said to him, look, I need to record this interview. And I pulled out my iPhone and he was in shock. He says, you'll get that out of here. You know, the NSA can use your iPhone as a microphone.
That's coming up on FSN Reports after our latest summary of the day's headlines.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Rebecca Foster. The G7 meetings in Brussels are wrapping up with the leaders of the world's biggest industrial countries warning Russia they'll impose broad economic sanctions if Moscow continues its destabilizing actions in Ukraine. The two-day meetings covered a number of issues, including the global economy and climate change, but the Ukrainian crisis continues to top the international foreign affairs agenda due to increasing violence in the country. G7 summit leaders say Russian President Vladimir Putin should recognize newly elected Ukrainian President Petro Poroshenko and engage in talks to find peace. U.S. President Barack Obama says he will judge Mr. Putin by what he does and not what he says.
We can't simply allow drift. The mere fact that some of the Russian soldiers have moved back off the border and that Russia is now destabilizing Ukraine through surrogates rather than overtly and explicitly does not mean that we can afford 3 months or 4 months or 6 months of continued violence and conflict in eastern Ukraine.
President Obama has also defended his decision to free five Taliban commanders from the Guantanamo Bay Detention Center in exchange for one American soldier, Sergeant Bo Bergdahl. The president was speaking in Europe, where his trip has been dogged by controversy over the decision. Washington correspondent Simon Marks reports.
Flanked by British Prime Minister David Cameron, the president dismissed the hoopla over Sergeant Bo Bergdahl's release as politically manufactured.
I'm never surprised by controversies that are whipped up in Washington, right? That's par for the course.
But here in Washington, he continues to face questions from lawmakers about the exchange and why Congress was not given the legally required 30 days notice that the so-called Gitmo 5 would go free. The president again cited Sergeant Bergdahl's health as the reason for his rapid decision and said he would make no apologies for it. Simon Marks, Washington.
A manhunt is underway in Canada for a suspect who shot and killed three police officers in the city of Moncton. Two other Royal Canadian Mounted Police officers were injured in the shootout. The city is under lockdown, with civilians urged to stay inside and shut their doors. Police say they are searching for 24-year-old Justin Burke, who they call armed and dangerous. They've released a photo of the suspect dressed in camouflage and carrying weapons, asking for anyone with information about his whereabouts to come forward. Moncton Mayor George LeBlanc told NBC the city is grieving.
This is a terrible loss and a tragedy for the families and for all of us here in the city of Moncton.
From bureaus worldwide, this is FSN. It's the 70th anniversary of D-Day, and veterans in Europe and the U.S. are marking the occasion with memorials and displays. Up to 4,000 Allied soldiers died on the day of the famous beach invasion that turned the tide of World War II. As many as 45 people have been killed in northeastern Nigeria in the latest attack by Boko Haram extremists. It's thought the extremists posed as preachers in order to round up local residents in the Borno state before opening fire. The Islamists' campaign of terror has claimed hundreds of lives in the last week alone. FSN's Africa correspondent Gary Alfonso says the attack is typical of Boko Haram's tactics.
their modus operandi of attacking villages and rounding up people and first of all spreading some disinformation and misinformation about the exact reason for their presence in that area and trying to create the impression that they are security personnel and then getting people out of their homes and basically shooting them at point blank range.
And the American Secret Service has made a request for software that will automatically detect sarcasm on Twitter. The agency hopes this type of software would enable them to better filter information in real time. Daniel Wrenches has the details.
The Secret Service wants a new software package to include the ability to analyze huge data streams in real time. But there have been several instances of authorities here and in Europe arresting individuals who made sarcastic postings online. Since the Secret Service request for this software was made public, everyone in America has expressed absolute faith that the software will work seamlessly, and civil liberties groups absolute delight at the notion of increased surveillance capabilities. Daniel Wrenches, Washington.
And that's the latest from Feature Story News. Rebecca Foster reporting.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Kevin McAleese. Welcome to FSN Reports. President Obama has reiterated his warning to Russia to cooperate over the crisis in Ukraine. If the Kremlin refuses, Mr. Obama said G7 leaders are united and ready to impose further painful economic sanctions. The US president was speaking in Brussels before heading to Paris to meet his French counterpart François Hollande ahead of D-Day commemorations. Our Europe correspondent Jack Parrock reports.
World leaders set out a list of demands for Russia in an effort to curb separatism in Ukraine or see sanctions widened to hurt the Russian economy. David Cameron, the UK Prime Minister, said those sanctions are prepared.
First, the status quo is unacceptable. The continuing destabilization of eastern Ukraine must stop. Second, there are a set of things that need to happen. President Putin must recognize the legitimate election of President Poroshenko. He must stop arms crossing the border into Ukraine. He must cease Russian support for separatist groups.
The US President Barack Obama also echoed those sentiments.
If Mr. Putin takes those steps, then it is possible for us to begin to rebuild trust between Russia and its neighbors and Europe. Should he fail to do so, though, there are going to be additional consequences. And one of the important things that came out of this meeting today was the recognition on the part of all of us that we can't simply allow drift.
The group of seven advanced economies meeting in Brussels without its eighth member Russia have placed instability in Ukraine at the top of their agenda. With issues like Ukraine's dependency on Russian gas and a subsequent price war influencing other agenda issues like climate change targets. The issue of Russia and Ukraine, though geographically distant, was also one close to home for Japan's Prime Minister Shinzo Abe, who repeated condemnation of China's claims to islands off the coast of Japan.
Whether in Ukraine or in Asia, the expansionism, which is as if to challenge the regional order, that is not something that we would tolerate by all means. So G7 leaders were united in communicating that clear message to the rest of the world. I think this was a great achievement of this summit.
But not all leaders were on the same page about ramping up pressure on Moscow. France still has an arms deal worth $1.7 billion to deliver helicopters to Russia, denting unanimity among European nations and the US on how to proceed with stricter sanctions. But France is set to play peacemaker as UK Prime Minister David Cameron, US President Obama and Russian President Vladimir Putin gather to commemorate the D-Day landings of World War II. The hope is that the war commemorations in France will provide an arena for diplomacy to calm waters over Ukraine. French President François Hollande is pushing for a meeting between President Putin and Ukraine's newly elected President Petro Poroshenko. All leaders have so far said they're willing to meet. Jack Parrock, Brussels.
This is FSN Reports. Dozens of people have been killed in the latest brutal attack by extremists in Nigeria's restive northeast. Boko Haram militants are thought to have posed as preachers in order to round up villagers in Borno State before opening fire. For more on the intensifying campaign of terror by the Islamist insurgents, I spoke to FSN's Africa correspondent, Gary Alfonso.
Well, another very typical attack by Boko Haram and their modus operandi of attacking villages and rounding up people and first of all, spreading some disinformation and misinformation about the exact reason for their presence in that area and trying to create the impression that they are security personnel or security forces, and then getting people out of their homes in very remote areas in Maguduri, which is the capital city of Borno State in the northeast, where many of these attacks took place in the outlying areas, not very well protected, and is pretty much very rural orientated communities outside of the city. So these Boko Haram groups rounding up people and basically shooting them at point blank range and very brutally murdering people in large groups.
Boko Haram's terror campaign in Nigeria, that was first brought into focus for the international community when 200 schoolgirls were abducted. That happened back in April. They're still missing, as far as we know. And one of Nigeria's senior military officials actually said that they knew the whereabouts of the abducted schoolgirls. Is there an update? What's the latest on the operation to get these girls back home?
Well, the military and the security forces are being very scarce with information, or at least not disclosing much information after that announcement by the head of the military that they knew where the girls were. That statement coming under quite some scrutiny from international and local forces, saying that perhaps that wasn't 100% correct. But we do know that some external forces, some Israeli army forces as well as American special forces, are in the area and have started with some surveillance programs, trying to, with very much pinpoint precision, find out where these girls are. There's obviously some reports in the intelligence circles that some of the girls have been split off and moved into other areas and are basically being used as human shields and protection. And these small groups of vigilantes, when we say small groups, some of these attacks, horrific attacks, happen with as few as 15 or 20 vigilantes, very well armed and on motorbikes, storming in and out. So very difficult to pinpoint where they would be hiding in large forests, large forested areas, and very, very densely growth-orientated border regions. So where exactly those girls are, still no exact detail, but pretty much very much the focus of what the Nigerian authorities are trying to correct in the next few weeks.
FSN Africa correspondent Gary Alfonso. Now, the European Central Bank has announced a series of unprecedented measures aimed at boosting the flagging Eurozone economy. The ECB has cut its deposit rate below zero, meaning banks will have to pay to park their money at the central bank, with the aim of encouraging them to instead lend it to businesses. London correspondent Ollie Barrett explained the significance of the ECB's steps.
It was David Cameron, the British Prime Minister, who coined the phrase, really, saying at the height of the Eurozone crisis that a big bazooka was needed to solve the area's economic malaise. And many analysts feel what the ECB has unveiled probably does count as at least a bazooka, if not a massive bazooka. The criticism has been that European policymakers and the ECB have been fighting an economic crisis up to now with a pea shooter. But critics are now saying, well, if the European economy is still so bad that it requires this major action, then what has the ECB been doing delaying these moves until now?
But the markets have reacted well?
Yep, initially all the major European stock markets jumped. The DAX in Germany went above 10,000 for the first time. The euro dipped against several other currencies, exactly what the ECB would have been hoping for. For many, even though that negative deposit rate is an historic move and the benchmark interest rate is also at an all-time low, it's the LTRO that could be the most useful thing here for the European economy. A long-term refinancing operation. It'll see 400 billion euros pumped into the economy via the commercial banks. There will be restrictions in place to try and ensure that that money goes out in lending to small businesses and what the ECB calls the real economy. But there are still plenty of notes of caution around.
Ollie, is this the last throw of the dice for the European Central Bank? Or could there be more bazookas?
Well, market watchers here were paying really as much attention to the words and the demeanour of ECB President Mario Draghi as to the detail of what he was announcing. And he did say in his press conference that we are not finished here. And he made it pretty clear, really, that further action would be considered down the line if needed. It is a very tough job for the ECB because of such huge divergence within the Eurozone economy. Unemployment, just to take one example, is less than 5% in Austria and over 25% in Greece. Germany's economy is powering along pretty nicely, and many Germans are concerned about inflation. France's appears to be stagnating, on the other hand, and many people in Paris, notably at the Elysee, and President Francois Hollande will probably be absolutely delighted at these moves by the ECB.
Ollie Barrett in London. This is FSN Reports. Friday, the 6th of June, marks the 70th anniversary of the D-Day landings. The largest seaborne invasion in history saw British, American and other Allied soldiers begin an operation to invade German-occupied Western Europe in 1944. The bloody events following the Normandy landings saw the Allies retake occupied France from Nazi troops and contribute to the end of the Second World War 1 year later. World leaders, including US President Barack Obama, Russian President Vladimir Putin, will join European leaders, royalty, and of course, veterans of the conflict for a series of commemorations. Our reporter Catherine Drew caught up with one of the veterans who is heading to Normandy for the first time since landing there on D-Day.
They developed gliders and did it very successfully.
92-year-old Alex Reith was a staff sergeant in the British Army's Glider Pilot Regiment. He joined the army at the beginning of the Second World War, working as a bomb disposal officer in London before switching because he thought being a glider pilot would be more exciting. En route to Normandy from his home in South Africa, the British former pilot dropped into the Army's Museum of Flying for a trip down memory lane. The museum is home to glider planes used to transport men and equipment into fighting zones during the Second World War. Archive footage from the era describes the offensive.
Onto French soil, which the enemy had had 4 years to fortify and which his troops stubbornly defended, strong Allied forces had been firmly placed.
Reith took part in the D-Day operation, which saw 156,000 American, British, Canadian and other Allied troops landing along a 50-mile stretch of Normandy coast in a seaborne assault which was supported by an aerial bombardment.
I can see it now. Spread before me from about 1,500 feet was this vast armada, never been seen before, and it consisted of every type of boat you can imagine. Even battleships were in it to pound the enemy when they got near the coast. It was wonderful. There was activity all around. It was a one-off, never to be forgotten experience.
Reith piloted a glider with an army gun, a jeep and a small number of troops into Normandy. He helped other soldiers secure the area, and then his orders were to return to England so he could be used in other glider missions. He and other pilots made their way back to the beaches where the thousands of Allied soldiers had landed.
I remember when I got to England, I was wearing a German helmet, and this I had picked up on the way to the beach. The ground was littered, and I mean littered, with all sorts of corpses and destroyed and abandoned weaponry and machinery. And I lifted a helmet from one of them. When I got back to England, I put it on my head, I can remember, because the photographers wanted a shot. But it couldn't have been a very good photograph because it didn't get published.
Ahead of the glider train, as the South Country passed swiftly below,
the army used gliders during the Second World War to transport troops and equipment so planes could be saved for bombing missions. Flying the one-use glider was extremely dangerous. Many were shot down or missed their target landing zones. Alex Reith is visiting Normandy for the first time since his service in the Second World War and expects it to be an emotional time.
I was there on D-Day. I landed on the soil in Normandy. I survived then and I've survived since. You must understand that there were many others who did precisely the same as me, probably much more hazardous than what I did, and a lot of them didn't survive. So my thoughts are with them. A lot of my people I drank with and trained with and had food with were no longer there.
An estimated 4,500 Allied troops died on D-Day, the first day of months of fierce combat which saw the Allies slowly fight their way to victory against Nazi Germany. The 70th anniversary of the D-Day landings is particularly poignant, with the recognition that this is likely to be the last major anniversary attended by veterans. Catherine Drew, London.
And finally tonight, on June the 5th last year, Britain's Guardian newspaper published the first leaks from the US intelligence worker Edward Snowden. Exactly 1 year on, Mr. Snowden remains in Moscow on temporary asylum, with calls from the US government for him to man up and come back to America to face espionage charges. Our correspondent Dan Whitehead has been speaking with The Guardian's intelligence correspondent Ewan McCaskill, who flew to Hong Kong to meet Edward Snowden in secret.
On Friday, May 31st last year, I was in The Guardian's office in New York, and the US editor, Jeanine Gibson, called me over and said, I want you to go to Hong Kong tomorrow. And I said, sure. I didn't even ask her why. Just, if you're offered an assignment, some places exotic as Hong Kong, you take it. That afternoon, she briefly told me, we think there's a spy in Hong Kong who's prepared to hand over documents. At the time, we didn't take it too seriously. We thought, yeah, maybe there's a spy there, but chances are, 2 days in Hong Kong, guy's a phony, and, you know, it's a wasted trip. So we went there, not in expectation that this guy was going to be genuine, but just to check out whether he was for real or not. In Hong Kong, I flew on the Saturday with Glenn Greenwald and Laura Petraeus, and when we first met Snowden, he's 30 now, he's 29 at the time, but he looked about 22, 23. He looked like a student. And our initial reaction was, this can't be real. I mean, somebody as young as this can't possibly be the person that he claims to be. You know, he claimed that he worked for the CIA in Geneva, claimed he trained with the special forces in preparation for going to fighting in Iraq, claimed he'd worked for the NSA in Japan. He worked for the NSA in Hawaii. He worked for the NSA in America. And you thought, you looked at this guy and you thought, how is this possible? But it all turned out to be true.
So you'd established contact with Edward Snowden, and you now had a period of time before the first leaks were published in The Guardian. Explain how that process worked and what it was like in the hotel and what Edward Snowden's behaviour was like.
When Glenn and Laura went to see him, he said, you'll identify, you can find me. I'll be at the Mira Hotel in Kowloon. Go to a small room next to an alligator crocodile. It seems a bit strange, but it was an ornamental crocodile. And he said that I'll be standing there with a Rubik's Cube. And that's how the first encounter went. And then they went back to his hotel room. I saw him the next day. Myself and Glenn joined Snowden in his hotel room in the Mira. And all the time, the 4 days we were in Hong Kong, it was always really tense, because we expected at any point, you know, the CIA or the Chinese authorities or the Hong Kong police or a bunch of gangsters, and Snowden said this himself, you know, would come barging through the door. I mean, if you're dealing with a spy that's got tens of thousands of documents, I mean, you can expect. So, and every day that we went to see him over those 4 days, my expectation was he wouldn't be there. They'd have been lifted in the night, they would have found him. So it was tense. And Snowden added to this tension because he was rightly paranoid. He was expecting to be lifted. He took all sorts of safety, security precautions. The very first time I met him, the first 5 minutes, I said to him, look, I need to record this interview. And I pulled out my iPhone, because that's what I use now, rather than a tape recorder. And He was in shock. He says, you'll get that out of here. You know, the NSA can use your iPhone as a microphone. They can listen in on our conversation. And I had to go and put it in the freezer compartment of a fridge, because that's the only way he thought it would be safe. In his room, he piled pillows up against the door jamb in case somebody was eavesdropping from outside. But he was rightly, paranoid. And whenever the phone went off, he would be jumpy and panicky, thinking this was somebody trying to get him out the room.
And this was just, what's the timeline? This was just days after he'd taken these, or the loaded four laptops worth with information, because he'd flown from Hawaii to Hong Kong, hadn't he? So, you know, he was feeling apprehensive of what have I done? Have I done the right thing? Did you get a sense of that from him?
He was. I mean, he was incredibly courageous. He flew from Hawaii and arrived in Hong Kong on May 20th. And he had all these tens of thousands of documents. He didn't know. He was sort of naive about the media. He didn't know that we were going to turn up. So he was taking a gamble. He'd taken all these documents. He couldn't put them back. He was going to be found. He just hoped that the journalists were going to turn up. The Washington Post were going to send a reporter, Bart Gellman, and decided against it. I think because the Washington Post lawyer said, look, you're going to a US citizen meeting a spy on Chinese territory. You know, that's sort of legally dodgy. So the Washington Post decided against going. Snowden wasn't to know. Could just as easily have the Guardian could have reached the same conclusion and decided not to send anyone. So it took a lot of courage. And he was sitting in that hotel room from May 20th till we turned up, the first couple of days of June. I think he was a bit relieved, you know, when we turned up and with the first documents and we spoke about the first story. But for the first 4 days until the first story appeared, there was a real tension.
What do you think that the main outcome is of what The Guardian has achieved by publishing these things? Is it an element of you've exposed surveillance which people, average normal people who are using Facebook, shouldn't be exposed to? What's the main thing that you, as the paper, have achieved, do you think?
Well, Edward Snowden wanted a debate about the nature of surveillance v privacy, and he's definitely got that. And I think that's, for The Guardian, that was the biggest achievement. This technological revolution that gave us the internet, the surveillance agencies have exploited that. And I don't blame them for that. That's what intelligence agencies do. But this happened without a sort of corresponding oversight, you know, by, say, the House of Commons or Congress, proper judicial review. And that's what we're having. We're having this debate now about what kind of constraints we should have on surveillance, how important privacy is to us. And I think that's the main achievement of Snowden. We are all now less naive than we were a year ago.
Dan Whitehead speaking with The Guardian's intelligence correspondent, Ewan McCaskill. And a special extended version of that interview will be coming up soon on FSN Reports. But that's Thursday's edition of the show. Coming up on Friday, the former Obama administration official who says he can no longer defend the US policy towards the Syrian civil war.
The efforts that we have made to date have not worked. They have not put enough pressure on the regime on the ground, and that's why the peace talks that we tried to do in January and February in Geneva, and I was there, and the regime completely refused to discuss a political settlement. Policy has not brought them to the point where they feel they have to negotiate. They're not under enough pressure. So we need to think about how to escalate pressure.
That's Friday. But for now, I'm Kevin McAleese in Washington, alongside producer Simon Marks and Rebecca Foster on the Bulletin Desk. For everyone, with feature story news everywhere, have a great evening. Goodbye.